Well, who likes to read stories or watch movies where good triumphs over evil? Right? That's probably all of us, right? We like to see those and watch those and read those. And one fairly common feature of these movies is the characterization of the followers of the evil leader as stupid or foolish. In other words, idiots, right? Sometimes they are lovable idiots. Even if you haven't seen a movie from the Despicable Me series, who hasn't seen a picture of a minion? Does everybody know what a minion looks like? You know, he's got like the shape of like a little cocktail sausage, like a hot dog kind of scrunched down. He's yellow. They always wear blue overalls, you know, these overall short kinds of things. Sometimes they have one eye with goggles. Sometimes they have two eyes. I don't think I've ever seen a three-eyed minion, but the cartoon exceeds in part because it's a spoof on the idiotic nature of evil. But usually the followers of the evil leader aren't lovable. They're evil idiots. Evil is never lovable, even if the characters are laughable. Often the evil idiots provide moments of humor because, well, their actions are idiotic. In a sense, they have to be, because evil, in some sense, is idiotic. If you Google the phrase, surrounded by idiots, by far the video that pops up is for a scene from Lion King. All right? Yeah, it's at least a favorite of at least two people attending today. The scene is of the evil lion Scar, you know, and before him are two of his evil minion hyenas, and they're being idiots. They're going moof moofafa, you know, you know, they're just rolling around on the ground, and the clip ends with Scar declaring this, and I wish I could do it with his accent and his "I'm surrounded by idiots," you know, kind of thing, right? It's a laugh out loud moment. And you aren't laughing because you think evil is funny. You're laughing at the idiotic nature of evil. And there are times when we should laugh at the idiotic nature of evil. Why? Because God laughs. Psalm 37, 12 to 13 says this: "The wicked plots against the righteous and gnashes his teeth at him. But the Lord laughs at the wicked, for he sees that his day is coming." That's why God laughs. That's why we should laugh. God laughs at the wicked, for he sees that his day is coming. So in that sense, we should laugh. And if you take a step back from our passage today, it's laughable. You can also, you can almost hear the chief evil character in our story say to himself, "I'm surrounded by idiots." It's funny, I was talking, my brother called me yesterday, and I said, so he was asking me in church, and you know, I don't know if he was asking me what I was preaching on, but I said, here's my title for my sermon tomorrow, "Surrounded by Idiots." And he goes, "What? You as a preacher are going to give that title?" I said, "Well," so then I explained to him what I was going to do, and he, "Oh, okay," so he got it. But he gave me this funny thing. He said, "It's funny, but I don't know if it popped up on Facebook at that time or the day before, but you know how you, if for those of you who are on Facebook, sometimes, and I never respond to these, but it says, use three words to describe your state." So somebody said, "Surrounded by idiots." And my brother responded, "California." He doesn't live in California, he lives in Texas, but anyways, it's people, you know, people understand that. And you may feel uncomfortable with my use of the word idiot, but it's defined as a stupid or foolish person. Did you know that God called his people idiots? Not exactly using that term, but Jeremiah 4:22 says, "For my people are foolish," all right, there's the first part of the definition, "they know me not. They are stupid children." There's the second part of our definition. "They have no understanding. They are wise in doing evil. But how to do good, they know not." God's people are portrayed as idiots in today's passage. All of them. Mark goes out of his way to portray them as idiots, to portray them as foolish and stupid. And you can't help but think that Mark is intentionally pointing out the laughable nature of their idiotic actions, and the idiotic nature of these characters. And let's just say that we want to be on the side of God. Why? Because he always gets the last laugh. So be prepared to laugh today in a hopefully a biblical sense, right? A godly sense. So I invite you to turn in your Bibles to Mark chapter 14, verse 53. If you're using the Bible that's in the seat, it's page 1012. Page 1012, Mark chapter 14, verse 53. Last week, we looked at the betrayal of Jesus by all of his disciples. Judas betrayed him with a kiss, and the rest of the disciples betrayed him by hightailing it out of that situation, with one of them fleeing naked. And I think that's a clue, that Mark has given us that clue, that he's preparing us for the laughable nature of this incident today. A guy fleeing naked and leaving his, you know, you could just see, like, I mean, the cartoon wouldn't show everything, but, you know, you see this guy fleeing, you know, with the holding the coat, you know, the guy holding the coat, and phew, there's this guy. Pixelated out, fleeing naked in the background. It's funny. It's a laugh out loud moment. Verses 53 to 54 begin to provide the top layer of our Mark and sandwich. So today we have another sandwich. Mark serves us up another sandwich, and we're not going to show it now. We've got a picture of that. But let's begin to look at the top layer of our sandwich. And it's just a beginning. And they led Jesus to the high priest. And all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes came together, and Peter had followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. And he was sitting with the guards and warming himself at the fire. So the high priest is the top evil guy in our episode, and he is surrounded by his minions, the chief priests, the elders, and the scribes. The guards are also part of his minions. One of the first laughs I got out of these verses is the presence of Peter. Sorry, the first thing that I do when I prepare a sermon is I decide what, you know, what passage the Lord is leading me to, and structurally what is the passage that I should preach on based upon the text. And so I print it out on a sheet of paper and I smoosh it up so the column goes all down the side of the page with all this blank space. Then I grab some colored pencils and I circle, you know, common characters, common themes, you know, just whatever kind of sticks out to me. And what I do for evil characters, I use black. I circle the evil characters in black. There's a lot of black evil characters in this passage. And because Peter kind of sticks out like a sore thumb, you know, here in this passage, I circled Peter with hot pink. And once I did that, I looked back, I laughed, because here's this hot pink Peter is surrounded in a sea of all these black evil characters in our story. It made it even more poetic. What is Peter doing? He's rubbing shoulders with the guards. He's like rubbing shoulders with being buddy-buddy with the guards and the bad guys at the fire. What makes it even more humorous is Mark's choice of the word that is translated as fire. The funny thing is that there's a normal word for fire. Mark doesn't use it. Mark uses the normal word for light. Excuse me. Peter's warming himself by the light. Peter, it's as if Mark is giving us a hint that one of the spotlights on this passage is on Peter. Peter's in the light. Excuse me. Peter has the spotlight on him. And if I was to circle Peter's name again, I would use a flame orange color to make him stick out. It's just, the light shines on Peter, and that's one of the themes of our passage. The top layer of our passage is this: false witness. False witness is the top layer of our sandwich. We first see Peter's false witness in the phrase, Peter had followed Jesus at a distance. Peter was being false to Jesus. If Peter was being true to Jesus and a true witness of Jesus, He would be right there with him amongst the crowd, be right next to him or suffering whatever consequences would have happened if he didn't flee. Surely there's irony in Peter sitting with the guards at the fire. Peter is trying to remain incognito, sitting among the guards. Hey, I'm just one of the guys here, you know. Nothing different about me. But Peter has the light shining on him. The light is testifying to his presence. And the light will eventually shine on his heart. But before we get there, Mark changes scenes. It's like the camera, you know, it's like a good, you know, movie, you know. You got the camera focused on Peter and his face lighting up by the fire, and then, all right, we switch scenes. The camera focuses back on Jesus, and it continues our theme of false witness. Verses 55 to 59. And notice as I read that you see the word testimony and witness. These are all Greek cognates. So they're... I was going to try to translate them kind of all the same, but witness and testimony, that's all kind of referring to, they're just different cognates of the same thing. It's the word that we translate as martyr. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, We heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands. Yet, even about this, their testimony did not agree. The whole scene is a sham. Their false testimony is laughable. We should be laughing at this situation. The council isn't after justice. They're only there to try to prove Jesus guilty and find a way that he is guilty. And do you see the minions, the idiots in action? Mark describes their testimony twice, for instance, for emphasis, to make sure we get it. And how are they acting like idiots? Well, their testimony didn't agree. Their minions, the minions couldn't get their stories straight. The high priest was likely thinking along the lines, I'm surrounded by idiots. Could you imagine? You know, you're sitting there, you're seeing, it's like, he knows it. Perhaps the high priest is the high idiot for not like planning this out ahead of time and not figuring out consistent testimony. Verse 60, the high priest has finally had enough and decides to take matters out of his minions' hands. You can sense his frustration in his two questions to Jesus. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you? The high priest is frustrated by Jesus' silence up to this point. And given the situation, does Jesus have to speak? No. Why? Because Jesus' best argument was the inconsistent testimony of his accusers. Why speak? Maybe you've been in that situation. It's like, okay, I defer to my opponent. You know, they're making Jesus' case in a sense. Sometimes it's best to be silent. So how does Jesus respond? Verse 61. But he remained silent. He's still silent. He made no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? So Jesus continues to remain silent, so the high priest asks him that question. The ultimate question. The Son of the Blessed, by the way, is just another way of saying the Son of God. It's what's called a circumlocution. I've mentioned this before. It's just a roundabout way of saying God. Remember, they didn't like to take the name of God in vain, so there was just, and we're going to see another one in a second. It's the Son of God. Let's see if Jesus answers this one. Verse 62. And Jesus said, I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. So Jesus answers the high priest's question with an emphatic, yes, I am. And in the Greek, it's like, I am, for emphasis. So here's the meat of our sandwich. Faithful witness. Faithful witness. Faithful witness is the meat of our sandwich. Up to now, Jesus has not publicly revealed that he is the Christ. It's called the Messianic secret. Before the high priest and the council, though, Jesus declares two things. First, he declares that, yes, I am the Christ. No doubt about that one. Second, he makes a reference back to Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. He repeats before the council what he said not long before to Peter, James, and John, and Andrew, back in chapter 13, verse 36, just the last chapter. They will all see the Son of Man coming, or seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. And in the right hand of power, just being another circumlocution for God. The right hand of God. That's where the Son of Man will be seated. So let's go ahead and turn to Daniel chapter 7. If you're using the Bible that's in the seat, it's on page 884. Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 to 14. And let me read these verses. Page 884, Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. This is Daniel speaking. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. These verses describe in detail what being seated at the right hand of God means. What does it mean? Jesus will be given dominion, glory, a kingdom that all nations, peoples and nations and languages should serve him. And by the way, Jesus' dominion is an everlasting dominion. Have you ever seen an everlasting dominion yet on earth, governed by man? No, that's the kind of power that Jesus will have. And we're in that kingdom now. If you're a Christian, we become part of that kingdom. And Jesus is going to get power with it. I think the ESV has, doesn't it say power? Yeah, it's power with a capital P. That's what power with a capital P is. Jesus makes a faithful declaration, knowing full well what is going to happen to him. And we can't miss the irony in this passage. Jesus will judge those who are judging Jesus. Those who are judging Jesus will one day be judged by the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. If you're not following Christ and you're not following him, you are judging Jesus, because Jesus is the King, and the only way to follow him is to submit to him. But it's a willing submission. It's a loving submission. It's a submission that brings hope and peace in our hearts. Verses 63 to 65 begin the bottom part of our sandwich. Some of you may have already written it in because you know what's coming. False witness. False witness is the bottom of our sandwich. And the high priest tore his garments and said, "What further witnesses do we need? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your decision?" And they all condemned him as deserving death, and some began to spit on him and cover his face and to strike him, saying to him, "Prophesy!" And the guards received him with blows. What Jesus said was not blasphemy. In order to be blasphemy, you have to curse God. It wasn't even blasphemy according to their own law. The whole court scene is a prime example of what's called a kangaroo court. Here's how Wikipedia describes a kangaroo court. I decided to look it up. You know, I've heard that term probably most of my life, and I'm like, where did that term come from? Well, I found out. A kangaroo court is a quote-unquote jumped-up court, you know, hence the kangaroo jumping. I don't know, maybe kangaroo court, it rhymes, is better than a rabbit court or other animal that, you know, I guess rabbit court wouldn't sound as cool, but a kangaroo court is jumped up. It's typically convened ad hoc, which means just spur of the moment. All right, so that's what happened, right? Spur of the moment. It ignores recognized standards of law or justice. Well, that's true of this. It says, and carries little or no official standing in the territory within which it resides. Well, that's true. Now, the Jews did, the council did have some authority to do some things. They didn't have the authority to pronounce death, to kill somebody openly. Well, that's why they're doing it in secret, right? And that's why Jesus has already prophesied that he's going to be handed over to the Gentiles. So they did have some authority, but they didn't have authority to kill him, which is why they didn't. A kangaroo court may ignore due process and come to a predetermined conclusion. Well, they ignored due process according to their own law. They weren't supposed to do it at night. They weren't supposed to do it at feast time. And I could go on, but I'm not going to get into all that detail. And they came to a predetermined conclusion, didn't they? Death. The term may also apply to a court held by a legitimate judicial authority which intentionally disregards the court's legal or ethical obligations. Again, that's what happened. They all condemned him as deserving of death, and then some acted like idiot bullies. What did they do? They spit on him and covered his face and struck him, mocking his prophetic ability, which again is ironic, which is because Jesus prophesied back in 1033, and I've alluded to this already, that he prophesied that he would be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they would condemn him to death. Speaking of Jesus' prophetic ability, the bottom layer of our sandwich ends with the prophesied false witness of Peter. In verses 66 to 72, and I'm just going to read 71 right now. Through 71. And as Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came, and seeing Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, "You also were with the Nazarene Jesus." But he denied it, saying, "I neither know nor understand what you mean." And he went out into the gateway, and the rooster crowed. And the servant girl saw him and began to say to the bystanders, "This man is one of them." But again, he denied it. And after a little while, the bystanders again said to Peter, "Certainly you are one of them, for you are a Galilean." But he began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, "I do not know this man of whom you speak." This passage is dripping with irony. It's like squirting out all over the place and just dripping. Of course the servant girl recognized Peter warming himself in the light, right? He thought he was being incognito and, "Look, I'm just surrounded by my buddies, the guards." But no, a lowly servant girl of all people calls him out. She refers to Jesus as the Nazarene, which was not a compliment. So who's the idiot now? Well, look at Peter's idiotic answer. I neither know nor understand what you mean. That's a ridiculous statement. Prophesied denial number one. False witness and rooster crow number one. But the servant girl isn't done. She follows Peter. You know, Peter left out to the gateway. And she follows Peter and says to the bystanders, "Hey, Peter's one of them." And again, Peter denies it. Prophesied denial number two, and another false witness. What happens next further adds to this laughable scene. All right, so just picture this scene after what just happened. All right, so if this was a movie, you would see like the bystanders, you know, standing there, kind of like, yeah, looking at Peter, you know, like, you know, the wheels are turning in their head as they ponder the servant girl's statements, and they reach a logical conclusion. Peter is one of them because they know he is a Galilean. Now, Matthew makes explicit what Mark is leaving implicit. They recognize his accent. You know, I won't point out all our Southerners, but you know, some of us are from like Arkansas by the way they talk. You know they're from the South, just by the way they talk. I'm not equating Galileans to Southerners by any stretch of the imagination. So what does Peter do? Well, Peter, it's like he just took, he's denies Jesus on steroids, as we might say. He invokes a curse on himself and swears that he doesn't know this man of whom you are speaking, right? It's silliness. Seriously? Who hasn't heard of Jesus? Peter doesn't even mention Jesus' name to try to help emphasize his point. I don't know that guy. Who is that guy? You know? Peter has gone about as low as he can go. Verse 72 tells us immediately what happens next. And immediately, the rooster crowed a second time. And Peter remembered how Jesus had said to him, "Before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." And he broke down and wept. Mark's readers have been waiting for the second rooster crow. You know what's going to happen. Jesus prophesied, "Before the rooster crows twice, you're going to deny me three times." And there it is. Irony, perhaps. There's some more irony here. Even the dumb rooster pronounces judgment upon Peter. It's like, you know, he denies him the third time, and what happens? You know? Peter breaks down and weeps. So what's the overall point of this passage? Some of you maybe even figured it out since the blank is preceded by the article "and," so you know it's a vowel. So anybody want to tell us what the blank is and the main point? What? Idiot. That's it. Yes, idiot. The overall point of the passage is this: except for Jesus, everyone's an idiot. Who is surrounded by idiots in our passage? Jesus is surrounded by idiots. Everyone is acting stupid or foolish. Well, except maybe one character. Who's the only character that's not acting stupid or foolish in our passage? The rooster, right? The rooster is being faithful. He sounds off when Peter has denied Jesus for the third time. So has anyone ever had what is called a hero sandwich? All right, I don't recall ever having one. I probably have when I was a lot younger, but I've seen them on a menu and have heard about them. It looks like the hero sandwich, by the way, got its start back in 1936. And according to one internet article, the term likely comes from New York Herald Tribune columnist Clementine Paddleworth. Yes, that is her real name. You know, how would you like to have a last name of Paddleworth growing up in school? I grew up in a school where we got paddled. And there was a time when I was Paddleworth and I actually got paddled. But, you know, does that mean that she was naughty all the time, or her family was known as naughty and then Paddleworth? Or maybe, you know, maybe they were rowers. I don't know. But, you know, you just wonder where these names come from. Well, she said, in 1936, she described a sandwich so large, you had to be a hero to eat it. So that's where we get the term hero. Anybody ever had a hero sandwich? Nope. No heroes here? All right, we got a picture for you. We got a picture for you this morning. Man, that's a large sandwich, isn't it? Whoa. Well, that sandwich is, that's a picture of a superhero sandwich. You know, not only is it large, but it's a superhero. Not just any old hero can eat this sandwich. You have to be a superhero. And of course, and not to trivialize this, but there's only one superhero, isn't there? And that's Jesus. Think about all the movies that watch that have superheroes. You know, you got the Avengers. Are they perfect guys? You know, they're superheroes, but they're all imperfect. How about anybody else want to mention some imperfect movie characters? Cartoons, maybe? Nathan, Michaela, right? How about the Incredibles, right? Are the Incredibles perfect people? No, you know, all human super, you know, what we call a superhero are fallen human beings, and you see their fault. And that's, you know, if you've ever watched, I haven't watched all the Avengers series, but some of them, that's kind of the point of the movie, and it provides conflict. They're all imperfect. No one else but Jesus is qualified to eat the superhero sandwich. Our passage is filled with idiots, not heroes. The people that should be the heroes. Think about this. The people that should be the heroes, God's people, the high priest, the chief priests, the scribes, the elders, and we could call Peter the high apostle in a sense. The high apostle, they're all idiots. They're all false witnesses. It shouldn't be a surprise to us. Psalm 14, Psalm 53, and Romans 3 tell us that there is not one good, not even one. In order to eat this sandwich, you have to devour what? A lot of persecution, a lot of fear, a lot of sin. And there's only one person that can do that. That's the Lord Jesus. And only a true God-fearer is able to eat that. Only the perfect, sinless Son of God is able to eat the bread of sin and live in that sense. So now let's just conclude by a few points of application, some summary of what perhaps I want to make sure we take away from this passage. There's so much in it, but I want to give you three. You can't follow Jesus at a distance. Maybe some of you have already written that down. And so how might this look? Well, sin, of course, right? If you're sinning, you're following Jesus at a distance. That should go without saying. But what about some of the more subtle ones, like not identifying with Jesus to our friends, our coworkers, families, and whoever we come in contact? Now, this doesn't mean that we're shoving Jesus down their throat every time, every second of the day, but it does mean that they know that you identify with Christ. Very simple. But it's more than identifying with Christ. Jesus, let's say it this way. If people don't see Jesus in us, then we are following Jesus at a distance. How's that for a convicting one? Sharing Jesus is important, but it's more than that. It's if we don't live like Jesus, then we destroy our testimony and we become false witnesses. We all need help with that. We're all not perfect. Number two, if you don't deny self, you will deny Jesus. Mark chapter 8, verses 34 to 38 must have gone in one ear of Peter's and out the other. Jesus told them already, denying self is serious business. And let me read that. Jesus says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what can a man give in return for his soul? Obviously, the answer to those two questions is nothing. For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. Isn't it interesting? Those of you reading our book together and talking about shame and everything. If you're ashamed of Jesus now, he's going to be ashamed of you when he comes back. Denying Jesus isn't worth it. Denying self is. And to steal a thought from last week, watch and pray so you don't deny. Number three. Some of you may have written down this one already. We're all idiots. Yes, we're all idiots. Do you see yourself in this passage? That's the purpose of all these gospel narratives. We're in the whole Bible, we're supposed to see ourselves. I'm an idiot. You're an idiot. We're surrounded by idiots. The church is full of idiots. Why? Because we still do stupid and foolish things. Now, I'm using that in a hyperbolic sense, okay? So I'm using it more in a poetic metaphor. So you have to be a little bit careful. Have you heard about the new store that's created for us to shop at? Anybody heard of it? It's called Idiots R Us, okay? Thankfully, though, we're saved idiots. And we're saved only because there was only one who wasn't an idiot. And that's Jesus. But Jesus did something idiotic. Think about it's idiotic trying to explain that to people sometimes. They're like, oh yeah, right. You know? The perfect Son of God suffered the wrath of God for us. Sounds like an idiotic plan, doesn't it? To rescue mankind. And if Jesus' sacrifice doesn't blow our mind and compel us to deny self, then we're just like Peter. We are following Jesus at a distance, and denying him. Let's pray.